thank the organizers for the invitation. It's actually great to be here. It's a pleasure. So what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Carlos Kenny. And is this too low? Or is it okay? Is this better? I'm sure. Is this better? You know, my shoulders are a little sensitive, so I have a problem lifting weights. Somebody maybe can do it.
Because a lot bigger.
Okay, so I'll try not to keep you too much after one. All right, so this is joint work with Carlos Koenig, and actually what I'm going to, it's a little bit more on the pure side of the talks that we have been hearing, but I'm really glad that I'm coming after Jalal Shatta in particular, because he sort of helped me a lot in putting this problem a little bit into the historical context and also into the applications and where it comes from. So what I want to show is just an improved local in time existence and uniqueness result for the hyperbolic elliptic Ishimori system, which I'll tell you in a minute, which actually it's a generalization of the two-dimensional classical continuous isotropic Heisenberg spin chain studied by Bardo, Sulem, and Sulem. That Jalal talked about. So the tools that I'm going to use are like standard sort of gauge geometric tools that I'll try to go easy on, or as easy as I can. Classical energy estimates, and actually a new method that is in the Kohan-Zvetkov work for the Benjamin Onon equations that was somehow recast by Carlos Koenig to study the KP1 equation and also sort of the generalized Benjamin Onon equations. Okay. So let me tell you what the system is. So the system in question has this form. So you know that the difference between this and the Heisenberg spin chain that was studied by Bardo, Sulem, and Sulem is that, okay, first of all, you don't have this term, there's no coupling equation, there's no extra potential there, and instead of having a box hyperbolic, you have the Laplace operator, okay? So here, S is a mapping to the sphere, and K kappa is a constant, and, oops, there's no parenthesis there. And this was proposed in 1984 by Ishimori. And from what I understand, I think that is because at that time, I know nothing about the subject, but at that time, I think that people believe that this equation, what he proved is that this equation has vortex solutions. And he showed that when kappa is 1, this is an integrable equation. And I think that at that time, there was some sort of like belief or people didn't know whether vortex solutions were something typical of non-integrability. And so he was seeking to show a sort of modified equation to the Heisenberg spin that sort of was integrable and had these vortex solutions. And what I should say is that there is another Ishimori model, which is in which you have effectively here you have the Laplace operator and here you have box, okay? And for that one, he could not find vortex solutions. Actually, I think that that's very interesting. In some sense. Okay. Let me not go into that. So here pretty much is what I just said. So when kappa is 1, this is integrable. And in that case, sort of the linearized equation to this is the same, is sort of a gauge equivalent to the David-Stewartson system, which is solved by inverse scattering, and there is an enormous amount of work for this, and I don't mean to be comprehensive, I'm just mentioning a few names that are associated to this case, to the sort of integrable case, and so these are some of the mathematicians that work on it. And as I said a minute ago, when you have the Laplace instead of box and kappa is 0, then this reduces to the two-dimensional continuous isotropic Heisenberg spin system, and which can also be viewed, as Jalal pointed out, as a Schrödinger map into the two-sphere. Oops, that's a 2, not an S. Is in X and Y, okay? So two derivatives in X minus two derivatives in Y. This is 2D, I mean, this is R2. Okay, so so the system that I just showed you describes the time evolution of a system of static spin vortices in the plane. And the right-hand side of the second equation, the one for the potential, okay, so this equation, that there. Okay. Is actually the topological charge density of the system, and the integer values of this topological charge are given by this quantity, and they classify the static spin vortices. So when you have these vortex solutions, what you have is so it's a little bit richer than the radial case. You have this sort of a phase with excited modes, and these modes have the discharge, this sort of like vortex degree in them. Okay, and from the geometric point of view, and this goes to what I'm going to do next. This equation actually. Okay, can be also viewed as a pullback, okay, of a piece of the volume in the sphere. Okay, and that's going to be useful for what I'm going to do next. Okay, so our main result is going to be that this system admits a unique local in time solution for the Cauchy initial value problem with arbitrary data in the Sobolev class above 3/2. Okay, so let me just mention that the Cauchy problem for this system, in the case in which you have hyperbolic and elliptic, there is only actually one paper that I can find of in the references, and this goes back to 1992. It's a paper by Alan Sawyer, who showed that when the data is small, that means when the spins are almost parallel, you have a local and a global and a local and a global solution. And I'm not going to, I don't want to discuss today how do you pass from small data to large data in the local problem. So if you wish, just for what I'm going to show you, just think of small data, but there is a mechanism to run all these arguments that I'm going to show you next to sort of try to get large data. Okay, so what did Sawyer did? I want to show you quickly how did he, what was the point. So he first wrote the equation, the system in stereographic coordinates. Okay, and so he did the stereographic projection, and then the system has this form, becomes having this form. Okay, I have this, should use it. Okay. Have this form, and of course the main difficulty is to treat this term, okay, which is the derivative term. So what I should point out that actually Jalal spoke about is that in a if you were sort of in a radial case, then you don't have sort of derivative nonlinearities. Okay, so in this case, I'm in the general case, and this is the main difficulty. Okay, now what I should say is that you can assume the H1 norm of the map to be finite, but it's not conserved. I mean, rather, what is conserved is this quantity, which is sort of doesn't have a sign. I mean, it's sort of, and that's actually a problem. So in that sense, I would sort of like position this system a level harder than the Schrödinger map because of this. Okay, so in the Schrödinger map case that Jalal spoke about, you have plus. So what I should say is that this makes very difficult to prove things like energy estimates directly on the map, on the original system. I mean, it's very hard to control the H1 norm with this quantity. Okay, so here what he does is he proceeds with a parabolic regularization from this system, and then sort of does an energy method. And to pass to the global results, he relies on sort of the dispersive properties of this system. So I should say right off the bat that this linear equation, okay, if you look at its at what it is on the Fourier side, it's a measure that is supported on a saddle, and a saddle is a hypersurface in say n plus one dimensions with n non-vanishing principal curvatures, and therefore the decay is one, is the same as the Schrödinger, is 1 over t to the n over 2. Okay, so you have exactly the same Stricker's estimates as for the Schrödinger equation, and this you can find it was sort of worked out by Guidagli and South. Okay, I'll say more about that later. Not all of them, I mean, there is an endpoint. Okay, so what I'm going to do is work a little bit with the system in the same spirit as joint work with Stefano van Uylenbeek, and sort of in the same spirit that also the one-dimensional case and small energy two-dimensional case of Changshatta and Uylenbeek, and try to sort of gauge the system into something that would allow us to treat the derivative nonlinearity in a better form. Okay, so if you look at the system that Soyer was treating, also the presence of the of this factor from the stereographic projection is actually quite nasty. I mean, it's kind of not very nice. And the nonlinearity also doesn't have a nice form. Okay, so so what I'm going to start is sort of again, also with a description of the map in terms of a stereographic projection, okay? And this is what you can write as the H1 norm of the map. And I'm going to try to write a system in sort of in terms of the covariant derivatives, sort of coordinate free. Well, let me show you everything, maybe. Yes. I know people hate when people cover half. I mean, I don't like it. I'm a bit makes me claustrophobic. Okay, so you can see everything. All right, so this is the covariant derivative, okay, for the system. And if you write the system in terms of the covariant derivatives, it looks like this. Okay, so remember that I had this is the phi here is the potential, and I had an elliptic equation for the potential. So if you look at this looks exactly like that. So just as in the Schrödinger maps, you have also two more equations. This one that comes from the fact that the Levi-Civita connection has no torsion, and this one that you can think of as the fact that the curvature of the covariant derivatives are the pullback of constant curvature on the sphere by the map. And so you have these two, and if you look at this with all of this, you somehow have an overdetermined system. Okay? So now what we are going to do is okay, what is B here? B has this form, okay? So B believes at the level of the derivative of the map. So I'm one derivative below. Okay? So now, if you recall the equation for phi, I'm going to do something very simple, which is just I'm going to I think that I called this zeta at the beginning. Phi and zeta, the difference between phi and zeta is that I sort of renormalize it so that kappa appears on the second equation instead of on the first. And so this is the equation that I had, and now it looks in this sense, the second equation, the equation for the potential looks like quadratic on the derivatives. Okay, so it looks like that. So the point now is that assuming that you have finite energy of the map, there is an old theorem from 1982, I guess, of Karen Uhlenbeck that tells you that you can sort of, I call it the good gauge theorem, which it tells you that there is a global Coulomb gauge that you can apply to the covariant derivative. So in other words, you can sort of twist the connection to place this, the covariant derivative, as close as possible to the flat derivative. Okay? So if you do this transformation, okay, so I'm going to go, after this transformation, you go from the derivative. So this was the derivative of the map, with a factor coming from the stereographic projection, that factor. And now if you gauge, you go from B to U, that has this form, and how do the covariant derivatives change? They go from here to this form. Well, now what is the nice thing about this form, maybe I should remind you of the formula that you have for, should remind you if I can find the transparency quick enough. Yeah. So here you have the covariant derivative, right? So that was the formula for the covariant derivative. And now you sort of gauge it so that it looks like the flat derivative plus this connection term. And the nice thing is that the gauge has allowed you to get the connection term here to be regular, pretty regular, much regular than what you started with. That's the main point. Also, the fact that the A is real, which is important as well for energy estimate. So the fact that now you have a term here that is the A is J is real, and also you have an added bonus, which is the fact that the divergence of the A is zero, which doesn't help you in this problem, but it helps you in the Schrödinger maps. Okay, so if we do this transformation, so here, let me just put this quickly. This is exactly what I just said. The two equations that I was showing you are preserved. And then you have this term for the bracket. Okay, you have this is how it looks like. Okay, and these are gauge invariant equations. What is more important is what is A. I mean, I said that it's regularizing, so in order for you to understand the equation, okay, A, okay, because it has, okay, divergence free, I can write it, this is a two-form, beta is a two-form, and here you should forget, you see the diagonal terms are zero, and for all practical purposes, what you should think of is that this looks like this. So this is 1, 2, this is beta 2, 1, 0. And I'm going to abuse notation, and beta 2, 1 is the same as minus beta 2, 1. And I'm going to just call them beta. And so what is important then is that A, okay, is a pseudo-differential operator of order minus 1 applied to a product. And that's why it's regularizing. Okay, so it's, you have gained like a little bit there. What is not nice is the fact that the temporal piece of the connection has no regularization whatsoever, okay? And also the other thing that I should say is that it's non-local on the product. So whenever I have a term that has this piece in it, times u, I cannot really think of that as being cubic because I have a non-local operator applied to a square times u. Okay, so in other words, I have like a risk transform. If you invert Laplacian, A naught is a risk transform of the product. So that term is not regularizing. So that's something you have to pay attention. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to change some notation, and I wish I had another projector because I'm sure that by now you don't remember any of the equations that I had. But okay, phi was the potential. I had the Laplace of phi, an equation for the Laplace of phi being sort of the imaginary part of the product. So the Laplace of phi is quadratic in U, and I'm going to just relate them to be V just for visual purposes. And so again, the important thing is that if you think of this V are real value, the divergence of V is zero, and now if you go back to the equation for phi, what you realize is that phi is nothing but a multiple of the curvature tensor. Okay? So in other words, the coupling term that appears in this equation is just a multiple of the terms that you already had in the main part of the equation. So that is very nice because it allows you to think that this is actually a very innocent term. It's actually adding more terms of the same form that you had if kappa was zero. Okay? So in other words, if kappa was zero, if I had no coupling, I have an equation that up to a constant looks exactly the same as with the coupling terms. Okay? So you see, this term here is, is two derivatives of phi. So you see, it's I have a risk transform because you're inverting Laplacians all the time. Okay, so it's like that. Okay. Now, the risk transforms are not a problem in these terms. They're only a problem in the A-naught terms because here, these terms, you have still an extra derivative, so you can always get away from L infinity to invert this. But it's in the other term, in the A-naught, that give you trouble. Okay, so this is what I just said, that in some sense, the V and the A are very close to each other. Okay, so now if you rewrite the equation, it looks like this. A0, I haven't written it yet. Okay, A0 is going to come in a minute. Okay, so the equation can be written in this form. And now you have to work a little bit, and here's where the A0 is going to come. You have to work a little bit. And if you rewrite your equations after you have done the gauge, remember, so now I want to sort of rewrite my equation. Remember that I haven't done the gauge yet here, okay? So now I have this equation. And now if you do the gauge and you work a little bit, your equations are going to look like this. So you apply, for example, D is the gauge nabla. Okay, and you start, then your equation looks like this. U naught equals this. This is how the equation looks like. And now you see, if you want to know for U1, you apply D1 to U naught, but D1 to U naught by the equations is the same as D naught U1, this commute. And what is D naught U1? Here you have your A naught. Okay, so you work out what the system is, and you end up that your new gauge system looks like this, where, remember, U lives at a derivative level of the map. So you're wondering, what is all this mess? And I guess that I'm just going to tell you to forget about it and just focus on the following. I have the linear part, okay? Then I have the derivative term that looks very nice because it has, here you see I have some sort of structure in the nonlinearity, which I'm not going to get to use at this point, but it should be helpful when you go down to the critical level. A's are real, okay? And then you have other terms which look as follows. This term, remember that A1 is sort of quadratic, so this term looks like a quintic term. But because it's an inverse Laplace of a quadratic term, it actually is scaling like a cubic term. So this is what I'm going to call pseudo-quintic, okay? And then you have terms of this form. So some of them are purely cubic, and some of them, like, I can't remember if it's this one or this one, are the same as the A-naught. In other words, is a non-local operator to a quadratic term times U1, okay? Now, what is important here is that all of these gammas are just constant, but the only one you need to pay attention to is gamma 1 that is real. Okay? Because you don't want to to ruin the reality of A1, A2 for your energy estimate. So I guess that here I'm just saying the same thing that I just said. So A1 is what I told you, one is cubic, the other one's okay. So this is what I'm going to call the modified Shimori system. So again, let me just repeat the same thing. The point of the gauge is that, first of all, this is a global change. So you see, these are geometric equations, so you want to take into account if you want to take into account the geometry of the equation into the system, whatever transformation you want to do, you want to do it globally, right? Because otherwise, you're not looking at the geometry. So first of all, this is a global change. And the important thing is that the derivative nonlinearity, which is the main headache, becomes real and smoother. Okay? And actually for this system, I lie to you a little bit because this here, okay, because of the minus, I don't have the divergence of this A is zero, but because I have a minus instead of a plus, this doesn't have null form anymore. Okay? The null form comes when you have here a Laplacian, which is the Schrodinger map case, in which then here you have a plus, and because the divergence of A is zero, this has a structure. So. Okay, the last thing that was, so then let me just say this quickly, because I don't have time to go into this, that, okay, the estimates are sort of independent of the coordinate choice. And the other thing that I should do is that because you started with an over-determined system, you cannot, once you go back to the modified system and you find the solution, you cannot sort of go back directly from solutions to the modified system to solutions here, but rather you have to follow sort of like an approximation argument, and then it works. Okay, once you find the local solution, you sort of use the fact that you have smooth solutions, like pretty regular solutions, and that you have estimates, energy estimates for the differences, and you go back like that. Okay, so now I'm going to study this modified system, and I want to prove that I have now the modified system lives at the level of the derivative. So if I want to prove what I'm going to prove is that this system has a local solution when the data is in H1 half plus. So that will imply that I have a map in H3 half plus because I'm one derivative below. So I'm going to now forget about the whole messy system. And here delta, now this is extremely general because now I'm writing this. But what I'm going to say from now on applies to absolutely any system for which you have here a nonlinearity that is kind of scale like cubic, I mean two dimensions. Here, instead of box, you can put any second order differential operator for which you know you have Strichers. So in particular, of course, you can put the Laplace, but you can also put, for example, the operators studied by Staffilani and Tataru that have coefficients that actually Jared we talked about a little bit. And what is delta here? Well, delta, in this case, if you were here on the Schrodinger map, if this is a Laplace and delta is a divergence, and this is still a divergence, but it's just that I call it delta because it has a minus sign in it. So here it is. Delta stands for, instead of the divergence of W, it has a minus here. Why do I have this form? Well, because you see, A, remember that A is sort of quadratic. So at the expense, so my system has the first order term looks like this. But A is quadratic, so at the expense of adding an extra cubic term, I can pass, I can pass this. There. Okay, so I'm going to put that extra cubic term in the F. And so if you think for all purposes of the estimate, you can forget about this funny divergence, you can just think of this being the divergence. Okay, so A, a real value, they satisfy the estimates I showed you before, and this is the main nonlinearity term. As I show you, you had this term, okay, you had that term, So maybe I should put here also a tilde because I don't have gradient. I have like a minus in front of that. So this is what I just wrote on the blackboard. Okay? And F has cubic terms and these pseudo-quintic terms that scale like cubic. So now I'm going to study that and this what I'm going to say now applies, again, let me just say this because this is the nice thing, applies to any system for which you have Strieker's and for which you have energy estimates, actually. Well, so you can put both or anything. So let me tell you what are the tools. I mentioned this before. This system, okay, if this, you have a classical smooth solution for this system, then you have the Strieker's estimates, provided that the exponents Q and R are admissible, which is this. Okay, you are not allowed to take L2 in time, L infinity in space, when you're in two dimensions. So in our case, we don't have this. With L2 on the right-hand side, when Q is 2 and R is infinity, and of course this estimate followed by the combined work of course, first Strieker's, Guidagli and South for this particular case that I'm talking about here, and the endpoint was settled by Kiel and Tau. So let me show you how do you start. Well, all you need to start are two things. Energy, this second estimate that follows from Strieker's, which is used in the dispersiveness of the equation, an energy estimate. So what is this? What is that I'm doing here? Well, you know, you don't have L2 L infinity, but I am studying a local problem. So if I use Sobolev embedding and I'm allowed to lose a little bit of derivatives here, like epsilon derivatives, then I have this estimate. This just follows from taking a point Q very close to, so I'm in two dimensions. I don't have this. This is 1/2. This is 1 over Q. This is 1 over R. I don't have that point. But I have Strieker's here. So, you know, you take a point very close. You take a Q naught very, very close, epsilon close to the missing point. You use Sobolev. And then you pass from the Q naught to L2 by Helder, and you have this estimate. So that's nothing. So this is the main thing I'm going to use. So this one, and the energy estimate. And the energy estimates are as follows. Now, you see, the energy estimates usually are easy to prove just using the Fourier transform, if you don't care to see how very much about what's the dependence of your estimates in terms of the first order coefficients, the first order terms, right? So, you know, if I don't care much about which norms appear here, okay, then one can actually prove this estimate using just the Fourier transform, and it's very simple. But actually, you care a lot about the dependence on the connection term on this A, on the coefficients of the first order term, on the right-hand side, and you want them really to have in terms of the of norms that you can control somehow. And in order to prove this, actually, this energy estimate is the same estimate that we proved with Stefanova and Uhlenbeck in the Schrödinger map case. And what is interesting is that in order to pick up here the L infinity norm of the gradient of A and not something like the L1 norm of the Fourier transform of the gradient of A, we have to proceed by Little-Paley theory. And the same argument works here if you have box instead of Laplace. Okay, it's the reality of A is what you need. Okay, and you also have estimates for the differences. Okay, so why this estimate, why I'm insisting so much on the first order terms? Because of what I'm going to tell you now. Now, remember here, I have one L infinity in U, one HS in U, and here is HS. So this is kind of a nice, it's like, look at this term. Forget about this one, okay? This is like same as always. But the important terms are this term and this term. And what I'm going to tell you now, right, is that actually this term and these terms are nothing but the square of the L infinity norm of U times the square of the HS norm of U. So I'm going to these remarks. You see, remember, I mean, for a classical smooth elliptic problem, I can get away from the L infinity, so I can invert this away from L infinity. I have enough smoothness, and so this is controlled by this, just because it's an algebra. This was quadratic in U, so this is an algebra, and here this follows by the Leibniz rule. Okay, so this is true for every t in the lifespan of the smooth solution. And as a consequence, you can recast your energy estimates in this form. And what is nice, what is important here is to notice this term. So this is your sort of the fellow you have to pay attention. Why? Because you see, I want to prove an estimate in H1 half plus, if I were in H1 plus, then you are done because you just closed by Sobolev, as everybody here knows, right? So the point is, how do you beat Sobolev? And what I'm going to show you next is an a priori control on the L2 and infinity norm of the solution, which is exactly the endpoint for the point that you're missing for Strieffer's, okay, that allows you to gain the half derivative. So you see, this estimate somehow lets you go halfway in between what is your critical level for this equation, which is L2, and what Sobolev gives you, which is H1 plus. And so you gain half a derivative and by this a priori estimate, and I'm going to show you in the remaining time how you do that. So this is the main idea that we actually follow very closely, Koenig's ideas in his work on the KP1 equation, that, as I said before, in turn follows or is based on the argument of Kochenfeld-Kopf for the Benjamin Ono equation. Actually, in this paper, Kenny calls this estimate. So for KP1, you have a quadratic nonlinearity, so he only has power 1 here, so he only needs an L1, L infinity estimate. So what is important here is that I need L2, L infinity, because I have a square, but if you had a quadratic nonlinearity, you can repeat the same argument for L1, L infinity, whatever you need. So this is the main proposition, and as I said, follows very closely Koenig's proof. Okay, so you have a solution for your problem. That was the one that I wrote before. The constant here. Then the L2 and infinity norm of the solution is controlled by the L infinity. Okay, so this is just energy. Okay, and now you see here you can pass to the L2 estimate, to an L2 estimate on your nonlinearity. And I'm cheating a little bit because I could have written this on the right hand side. This is a little misleading, right? Because I could have, forget about this term, I could have written for the full nonlinearity to look like that, and that's your half derivative gain. And so I decouple a little bit the first order term. And why do you have a half? Well, because you have minus a half, but then you have a divergence, so you end up with a half. And that's your gain. Okay? That there is your gain. So this is the main lemma, okay, that will allow you to gain. This is exactly the place where you gain half a derivative. Now, the important remark, and this is what I said before about this temporal connection term, dA naught, that is not regularizing, is that in order to treat that term, you see, if you want to invert an elliptic operator in L infinity, right, the risk transforms that don't map L infinity to L infinity. They map L infinity into BMO or something. So you can sort of control those terms if you don't care which norms you use. But if you want to go back to the norms that you started with, you have to actually treat this operator, you want it to be back in L infinity, and it's not. And this is actually a problem that appears in wave maps as well. I mean, it's a problem that has appeared before. So how do you deal with that? Well, you deal with that by actually noticing that if you are in a sort of frequency band, at a fixed frequency, then the L infinity norm and the sort of the BMO norm are sort of the same, are equivalent. So you treat it by noticing that actually in the left-hand side here, you don't have just an L2 L infinity, but you have a BS of type L2 L infinity. You have something like a little L1 BS of L2 L infinity. So in fact, when you prove this lemma, what you prove is that this norm, this is just a little Paley decomposition, this norm is less than or equal than this part, and then trivially this is less or equal than that. And that's what saves you. Okay? This is absolutely crucial. I mean, this problem appears a lot, as I understand, it appears in wave maps, but also appears in Kleinemann-Rodiansky work on recent work on Einstein's equations. They have to actually work very hard to get kind of a VS of type norm to control the inversion of the elliptic operator in L infinity. Okay, so once you have this, I'm almost done, maybe. Okay. I had to run so much that my hunger is gone. So, well, I was hungry, but anyway, never mind. Okay, so once you have this, you are done, because now how do you finish? Okay, what do you do with these two lemmas? Well, first of all, let me give you the a priori estimates for the right-hand side of the lemma that I just showed you. So I want to now, okay, here, this term is, of course, where your solution is going to be. This is your solution space. I didn't tell you what J is. Nobody asked me, so J is the usual. Somebody else defined it before, so J to the S here is just the identity, is the Bessel potential. Okay, so here, what? Oh. Maybe I am hungry. Okay. So this is the solution space, all right? And so now you need to control these two terms, the nonlinearity terms, and the next lemma is going to provide those estimates. Okay? And this is sort of easy, so I'm not going to go through that, but let me maybe show you quickly how you get this one. And when you show you this one, it's actually very embarrassing, because you're going to see that I'm essentially wasting most of the gain of the derivatives, but there is a point. Okay, so let me just show you this one. Okay, so here you use just sort of the Leibniz rule, and you get this. Okay, now this term is easy because, you know, this is very regular. So this term is estimated just by whatever, here, the square of this. And this is sort of the tricky term, okay, because, you take A in L infinity, you use Sobolev. Remember that here's where you're using very strongly the fact that my A was more regular. So this is the point of the gauge. There are two points of the gauge. The fact that I could prove an energy estimate as I wished, as I wanted it, I use very strongly that A was real, and then here, because I gain a derivative, so I can use Sobolev here. And then you end up, again, you use Leibniz, and you end up with this term. And so you are going to ask me, well, why you only gain half a derivative? And I'm going to tell you why. I can repeat this lemma, okay, and this lemma uses only the corollary that I show you to the Strieffers. I mean, it takes the fact that you're integrating, it uses very strongly that, you see, Sobolev only uses the control of the L infinity. And here I'm using very strongly that you're integrating in time, and there's where you gain. It's this integration that allows you to gain. Okay? And so you wonder why I couldn't gain any more. Well, it's a little bit, what you do is you take this interval and you cut it into intervals whose size are 1 over the frequency that I am. So if my U lives at frequency 2 to the k or lambda, then I cut this interval into subintervals of length 1 over lambda. And so here you have a little bit of a game between the size of the subintervals and how many subintervals you have. And you have to optimize these two things. And, you know, you said, well, the best thing is 1/2. You can also say, well, I mean, I could have done a quarter here. I could have, you know, fudge a little bit with this argument and gain a quarter here. But if I put a quarter here, then here instead of a half, I end up with 3/4. And what's the problem with that? Well, the problem comes right here, because if you end up with 3/4, in this last step, when you want to control that, you see, if you have three-quarters derivative, there is one point in which you're going to fall, the three-quarters derivatives are going to fall here, and you can do nothing. So imagine that U is in high frequencies and A is in low frequencies. There's nothing you can do here but in infinity, and you're dead there. So that's the point where you're dead. Okay, so anyway, once you have these two, I'm almost done. What time I started? Anyway, I know what time I started. I'm almost done. So once you are this, then how do you finish? Well, what I just said up to now, I haven't used energy yet. So I have to tell you how you use energy. So you start, you take the first time, and now I said, okay, initially supposed to, you take the first time in this interval where you double the initial data. Okay? I mean, you always have a time in which you surpass it, otherwise you already have a local result, right? If you're always less or equal, you're done. So you always surpass it, and then, you know, these quantities continue, use the continuity to say, well, I have a first time in which I double it. And now I define this T naught, which is the minimum between the first time in which I double this and this quantity. Where this quantity came from the two estimates that I gave you before. If you look at the two estimates that I gave you before, that's just the right-hand side. Okay, so I'm just taking, inverting, you see, this, one-third of this. Okay? So now the point is that this lemma that I show you for that time, gives me an a priori L2 L infinity bound on my solution. Mm-hmm. And once you have an a priori L infinity bound on this solution, you can prove your theorem, because you say, well, why is it that I'm not done? You say, well, once you have this, you put it back in energy, and you close. You're done, right? Because you integrate energy, and you're done. But you're not done. Because nobody says that this T naught that I define for you is not zero. How do I know that I have a time? That T naught could be zero. And this is like a silly estimate. I have nothing. Right? So how do I know that this, I have a lower, but a strictly positive time, that I have an interval here, that I have an interval? Well, and to do that, and this is actually, I'm done now. And to do that, you need one more lemma that tells you a little bit more carefully what are the estimates on your nonlinearity, right, in terms of what you had on the right-hand side for energy, okay? And once you have this, you use energy. Is energy what allows you to... Okay, this is not... Forget about this. This is saying that, okay. And let me show you just the argument of how you find your lower bound. So remember, energy looks like this. Okay? And now you use energy to make sure that your time is not negative, because what you do is you integrate. You integrate everything, and now you use your a priori bound on that time to get this. And now here is where you have to use the fact that you had a Viesov norm and not an L infinity, purely L1 L infinity, L2 L infinity, but actually a Viesov type norm. And you control, you use your a priori bound on all of this, and the energy is the one that gives you the fact that the time is actually positive. And you close. And then you're done. Thank you.